All right, quick review. And the reason is I'm going to give you an assignment in just a minute where I want you to take these six foundation principles, and I'd like you just maybe go ahead and pre-teach the lesson to each other in our chat rooms. I'll give you some questions. In fact, before I forget, let me just do that now. Let's see. I've got to stop sharing just so I know where to find it. All right, so here's the chat. I'm gonna publish these questions to everyone now, and does everyone see there should be five questions that show up in the chat in the Zoom group? Oh, is it the group chat? I don't want that. No, everybody should see that. To everyone, oh, in the waiting room, I don't want that. To everyone. Thank you, Kay, for shaking your head so clearly. And let me try this one. How about now? Do you see questions in the chat? All right. Thank you, Emily, for nodding visibly there. All right. There's a personal infinite God. He is a real and apart from our consciousness, but he's the original creator of everything, right? And even if things appear in this world at some point later in time, they really still have their origin in God as the creator. He has personality and he communicates. He exists, however, outside of time and space. But he's immanent and acting in the world. And that is, he continues to control things and provide things for people, not interfering with man's free will necessarily, except an influence for good, but still active in the world, even though he is outside time and space. Man is spiritual, sharing that aspect, is that characteristic with God, in that he has a spiritual consciousness in addition to his physical nature. He exists outside the machinery of nature. He can choose to respond with good or evil. There are serious consequences of his choices, such as the fall, and he is accountable to God for his choices, and more on that when we get to the final fundamental principle. The world, however, is fallen, and that includes the world of men who have chosen to sin, but it also includes an imperfect and kind of decaying world, universe in which we live. It's full of irreparable sin-caused imperfections, irreparable at least in this age. It continues the conflict between good and evil, and it's even within us. We wrestle with the forces and influences of good and evil. However, we can imagine an ideal, sinless world which doesn't exist. Maybe it did at one time. Maybe the memory of that is in our minds by God's design. But it's interesting that we see things that are evil in the world and we recognize them as evil, even though we've never really known another world. And so that's kind of interesting. Now, I hope if you're reading those five questions, that these might have something to do with it. The Bible's propositional revelation from God. It doesn't matter whether we accept it, believe it, but it is true and it's independent of our reception, but it's logical and we can perceive it as just as well as all other men. It's not, I'm sorry, I'm being reminded to let people in the waiting room, including Sewell, so I'm glad he's here. I'm glad I've let him in. It's consistent and it's grown more complete over time, and we can share it with other people, even though it came from God. And then, of course, Jesus came. That's number five. A more specific and powerful example of propositional revelation is the Word, who came in the flesh. And he also came with another mission to redeem man. He was physically present. His purpose was to communicate God's will. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And his actions were to provide a solution for sin's consequences, you might say the fallen world. And the final solution is the universe is temporary, awaiting a coming judgment in which evil is punished, sure enough, but also their imperfections of evil are also made right. Do everybody remember all these? That's a quick review. So what I'd like to do is I'm going to create a breakout rooms, and it looks like we're up to 40 or so. So what I'm going to do is... 35. So I'm going to make seven different rooms. Can you all remember these six foundation principles? We review them every lesson, right? You could probably say them quickly if you wanted to. Well, the five questions I put in the chat rooms, everybody got those? The five questions? Okay. So when I break into groups, immediately start working on those five questions, and that they're really kind of a summary of the lesson tonight. What I'm trying to get us to learn to do is take these foundation principles and kind of apply them to any issue in life, any question, and kind of step through each one and say, does that have anything to do with these five questions? And see if you can come to some conclusion. Now, when we're done, we'll go look in the Bible and show how the Bible kind of answers these things. But it answers them consistent with what you think based on these foundation principles. But I want us to learn to apply these worldviews to various questions. Everybody got the assignment? Okay, I'm going to stop sharing my screen. And I'm going to mute all because we have some loud folks. And that, and now since I've done that, I'm going to explain the assignment one more time. You're about to be broken into groups. Sorry, got three more people let in. All right, you're about to be broken into groups. Use the questions that are in the group chat. And the new folks, if you didn't get them, somebody in your group will have it. And so answer these, and we'll work on it for maybe about 10 minutes. And I'll visit the rooms occasionally, so if you have questions, I'll log in to have that discussion. Everybody ready? 3, 2, 1. Open. All right, I'm assuming everybody's back. What I'd like to do, I've got everybody muted, but I'm going to unmute everybody in just a second. I'd like very quickly for, you know, somebody, one person to speak up on each one, a different person maybe, don't the same person answer. Just on number one, just kind of say which of the foundation principles apply and whether you came up with a, you know, what the short answer was, all right? So number one, what's the origin of government and human authority? Which of the foundation principles kind of relates to that?
All right.
We said a personal and infinite God.
Why, Mike?
Why? Because all authority, whether it's government or human authority, really comes from a personal God who created all things.
Sure. Do you think there's anything in the world God didn't essentially create? I mean, they're really the origin of all things. Now, I don't mean to say that we don't actually, in our own minds, use what God's given us to do. But anyway, okay, that's good. So I think number one is the case, and we'll see in the Bible that actually there are examples where God actually placed authority in the world. Are governments more likely to be evil or good? Which of these foundation principles maybe is most relevant to that?
World is fallen,
right. And what does that mean? Is most likely a government's going to be evil or good?
Evil.
Yeah, I always think of the verse in 1 John 5, the whole world lies under the influence of the evil one. I wonder if that includes human government. In fact, I wonder if it doesn't often include anybody who has power over another human or has the ambition to have power over another human, which is often how you get that power to start with. So, number three, is there any ultimate regulation of governments, do you think?
The personal infinite God, because he's involved in the world.
Acts in the world.
You may not know how, but...
That's right. You would think that God would have some rule or providence in the world. And, of course, if you know the Bible, you know the verses we're going to show that God does rule in the kingdoms of men. But it just makes sense that if he does manage the world, and that's what we believe, that he would manage governments, just as he does manage something about our lives, maybe the hope that all men would come to repentance, for example, according to some purpose that he had. What's the final solution to evil governments? Is it the nuclear bomb? Is it the righteous nation of the United States that executes judgment on evil dictators around the world? Is that the way evil governments will be contained? What do you think?
Temporary universe.
Yeah, that's going to be the final solution. And really, just like all the imperfections in our own lives, the imperfections in the larger sense of governments really are longing for, I think, the perfection of that. And you could even think about you know, we live in a world in which there is cancer and decay and death and a lot of bad things, you know, scarcity of resources and all of that. And I wonder if God created authority even before the fall, if there's not the perfect authority the perfect kind of government structure out there somewhere. And we dream of it, don't we? Because we have a spiritual consciousness and we live in a fallen world. We know that there's a better answer than what's all around us. We've never seen it. We really don't have much hope for it. But I wonder if there's not some sense in which God makes that perfect. When the, you know, all the groaning of the creation finally comes to its fruition. Anyway, I'm going to unmute everybody. What should be a Christian's relationship to human government? That's a little bit harder, I suppose. What did you find in here that relates to that?
I think it's man is...
Man is spiritual?
Spiritual because he's following God's commands.
Oh, that's great.
To be obedient.
Yeah, there's some sense in which we have our own accountability to God, which transcends, maybe even guides and governs how we relate to government. So I think that's good. Yeah, that's really good. Okay.
So we also said that number three applies to that one as well, which is because the world is fallen and governments are inevitably going to be imperfect, therefore it's not a good idea to put your trust in them and expect the government to solve all of your problems.
Great. That's great. And what about number two? If governments are kind of most likely inherently evil, is it likely that we should form deep alliances with them? Does that seem like a practical way to go about it? No, it doesn't really seem like a good approach. You know, if we're trying to, you know, live in a way that satisfies what God's revealed in his revelation and in the example of Jesus. And you could look at Jesus' example, who revealed God. What did we see about Jesus' relationship to Caesar, for example?
Render to Caesar what's Caesar's.
And to God what's
God. God is God.
Almost as if those are two distinguishable things, if maybe not separate, but at least, yes. Okay, you guys have just done the whole lesson, all right? So I can go fast, but I'm just going to show you that if you read through what the Bible says about these questions, you're really just going to see examples of all the things I think you all have found here. Okay, I've put everybody on mute. There's some background noise and stuff, but if you want to talk, there's a trick I learned and tried the other night, and it worked. If you just hold your hand down on the space bar, it's kind of like one of those press-to-talk radios, and you go on mute, and when you let your hand up, then you're back on to mute. That seems backwards, but it's press-to-talk, lift up to be quiet. But that's anyway, if you want to do that. So please interrupt me and give me a break so I can breathe. But I am going to go pretty fast. We've taken half the time, but you all have done two-thirds of the lesson already in just thinking through these questions. Sorry, I have to make a little self-defense here. You realize the goal of this course is not just to go through all these doctrines. It's to help us see how the Christian views the world in a different way from everybody else. And really, when an issue comes up, like government, or next time about science, and what about saving the earth, the Christian should, I think, always have a kind of a little different view of things. All things become new, Paul said in 2 Corinthians 5. We really see things just differently. And it sometimes helps to think about how the world looks at it in contrast. But really, what I'm trying to get us to do is just practice, raise an issue, think through these foundation principles, and see if they don't lead us to a conclusion which is often quite different from what the world would believe. Would everybody nod with me and say, you see why we're doing this? That's why I'm doing the group exercises. Besides, I like to show off that I know how to do group exercises. But there's another reason for it, too. Okay. There are more complex questions like voting or should we go to court and all those kind of things. Those, I think, are similar. They're harder to answer in some ways, but I think they can still be informed by these same foundation principles and certainly by what God's revealed. Okay. Remember that I'm going through these questions that are in Lesson 5. If you have it and you did Part B, those are the questions I'm going through in order. And the numbers on the questions match exactly the number in the lesson sheet. Just so we don't forget her, I'll bring up the T-shirt lady briefly. And if you remember, she had a little opinion about government. In the first place, she was a little bit afraid that as fundamentalists or whatever she thinks we are religiously, that our intent would be to use government to try to vote in people who would enforce our moral beliefs on all the population, even on those who didn't have the same sense of right and wrong that we do. That was her first fear. Of course, whoever this crazy guy was talking to her said, I don't really think governments are going to be the answer. Well, that's a little, I'm not sure all Christians would have said that. So she's surprised that we're not politically active. Would anybody like to comment on why she thinks we ought to be political? Remember, she went on to say, I'm glad you're not, politically active because you'd be harmful if you were, but I don't understand why you don't think that's a good thing to do. What's her point of view? Where's she coming from in that? You'll have
to. Maybe she's thinking, how are you going to change? If you want something a particular way, you have to use the government to get this law or whatever passed.
Yeah. And what other solutions might there be? Well, bad ones maybe, like anarchy or some kind of, criminal thing or something that's outside the law and order approach of changing the government. Now, we live in an odd government. I mean, odd in the sense that most of the world and most of history would not even recognize the government we're in, where in theory we have some level of voice and, in passing laws and so on. I think maybe there is this view that if you're going to change man and change things in general, you just go to the most powerful thing you can think of to try to get those changes made. And what is that? Well, it's the government, right? They got all the money. They got all the policemen. They got the army and all that. Maybe that's the idea. And, of course, her belief, too, is that the government is pretty good, right? I mean, look at, it has ups and downs. Occasionally Republicans are elected. But other than that, things are actually on a path that, we're getting rid of slavery. We found that that women are now able to vote. And so isn't this a fairly positive picture of government generally? At least the U.S. government, I guess. Does anybody remember there? I'm sorry, Daniel had to go. He had another class at 8 to go to, but he teaches some history and stuff. That's his degree. Do you remember that phrase called manifest destiny? You remember that from your American history? No? Yes. The Pose dude. Do you remember what? I put you on the spot to remind us what manifest destiny was about. Nikki's the one that nodded.
She's the one.
So kind of the belief that it was the American destiny to just overtake the whole country from Atlantic to Pacific.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And I think it started with
the whole country's destiny, not Christian.
No, it wasn't Christian. It was the United States destiny.
Right, yes.
But who gave them that destiny? Who gave
God.
Them that?
God gave
them. Yeah, it came from God.
God gave them.
That we were supposed to take over, and I suppose in some sense, manage and improve and maybe make Christians out of all of the what's now, the United States, but all of that North American. And so the Louisiana Purchase in 1803 and, the Texas War, the war with the Mexico that got us Texas and then all the other southwestern states, that was justified by our manifest destiny. That is God's will, of course. I guess we just came to believe that. I'm not sure exactly why, because we were a good nation or something. And that was the justification for really, expanding the whole United States to the Pacific Ocean. But anyway, that would be consistent with the lady's view that, hey, we've just, we're doing great things. We're making progress as we go. And so, all right, enough of that. Let's go through the logic. And I'm going to go pretty fast, just like last week, because I don't think these are new concepts to most Christians that have studied these things. But I just want you to see that the things we saw in the foundation principles, they're actually revealed in the propositional revelation of the Bible. As history is explained by God, as laws are illustrated in the Old Testament and the New, and other various principles that God has revealed to us, they're really consistent with the answers to the questions y'all have already provided. I'll say that, and once again, I'm just going through the lesson questions. That's all I'm doing is these questions right here. Have authority structures been in place since the creation? Well, I think the answer is yes. In fact, before the fall even, there was a sense in which Adam was formed first and Eve was his helper. Now, I don't think they had many arguments, but I still think there was a sense in which he was a head of the woman. That's what 1 Corinthians 11 talks about. And in the same way that Christ is a subordinate to God, he did that voluntarily, and yet there was an authority structure there. And Paul even uses that argument to describe an authority structure of sorts in the church. when he refers back to Adam being formed first and then Eve. And so you can see he's saying that's parallel to now in the church. There's a kind of a role difference between men and women. You know, we always give the caveat, this is not a statement of value, but it is a suggestion that there's some authority of one over another. And just like the president is no more valuable as a soul than a citizen, but he does have a level of authority. We'll look ahead. Jesus said to Pilate, yes, you do have power of life and death over me, but you wouldn't have that authority, which you do have, except God gave it to you. So I wouldn't have ever put Pilate in a higher quality position than Jesus in terms of the value of their person or anything. But at that point in time, God had actually placed him in a position where he had authority over the fate of Jesus. So anyway, question two, and that is, are there some things that happen on the earth that are a result of fallen world and man making choices with his free will as a spiritual being, but they kind of require some sense of retribution? That is, there's a punishment needed, not necessarily always gotten, but needed. And of course, that's really true. In fact, not too long after the fall, you see that, you know, Cain kills Abel, and the blood of Abel, righteous Abel, cries out from the ground. And the Hebrew writer makes a later reference to that as crying out. And then again, after the flood, Noah is told, look, if you kill somebody, then you need to be killed because you've destroyed something that's in the image of God. You see the foundation principles repeated there. And actually then it's reflected in the need for a punishment, a death penalty, really, for a murder. And so that's what God told Noah. So, and so on. We could go on about that. In fact, if I could remember it, does the sense of this of injustice crying out, does that live on into the New Testament at all? Can you think of a verse that that has something to do with that? I think I have a bonus chart in here somewhere. Where is that?
Is it the scene in Revelation where the saints are crying out from under the altar?
That's good. That's not what I was thinking about, but that's a good one. Yeah, same thing. Let's see. I have it in here. Well, I'll just tell you. You can look it up. You know where it is. It's James chapter 5, where James says that woe to the rich. It's kind of like, almost like he's turning into one of the Old Testament prophets, and he's pronouncing woes on rich people. But he says, those wages of the laborers who harvested your fields is crying out against you. And there's certain judgment coming to you for that. So there's a sense in which all of murder and other crimes still today, when they're done as an injustice, that cries out for retribution, punishment in some way. And I think it's just part of the groaning of the creation, you know, in this imperfect world. Okay. So, yes, there's always been sense of retribution for sins in this world, in this, you know, in the nation of Israel. The land actually would cry out for the injustice there. However, maybe this is the reason for that, is that from the beginning, men have always tended to abuse the concept of justice. Just like anything else God's created that's good, a fallen world or a sinful man can find a way to go and make evil of that. And the example I think of is Lamech. Surely someone wounded him, right? Somebody wounded Lamech. Did that cry out for punishment? Well, perhaps it did. Did it cry out for Lamech to kill the guy? No, it didn't. But that's just kind of the way we are, isn't it? We take something that seems natural and we make it unnatural and sinful. And so he killed a man for wounding him. And then till finally before the flood, it seems like every intent was only evil. So maybe even good ideas that something should be punished still gets turned into evil and overdone. I think we see that in our culture of revenge and, you know, pride killings and other things like that, where maybe there's some germ of something good in that, and that is evil shouldn't go unpunished. Maybe that's a right concept, but it just goes way too far. And of course, it's allowing us to express our anger and other things in the wrong way. You get to Genesis 11, and there's the Babylonians in their first appearance in this play. And we get to see their nature, and that is they're full of pride, and they're going to work together to build a city, to make a name for themselves. And so here's this, you can imagine authority structure built around the city, this great city, And what are they going to do with it? What are they going to do, things that contribute to human pride? And of course, you get then to chapter 13, and Abraham gets into the land of Canaan, and the men of Sodom and Gomorrah were exceedingly wicked, and you know the whole story related to that. And finally, God says to Abraham, you know, this land is yours, and I'm going to give it to you, but it's not going to be right now. And I think Genesis 15:3 has the vision, and God kind of outlines the whole next 400 years of history. And he says, you'll come back, but it's not time right now, because the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. What's the implication is in 400 years, what? It'll be complete. Which way is it going to go? Is it going to get better, or is it going to get worse? You know, and you can kind of see the way God says it's going to go. And that's exactly what happened. So generally cultures, and especially authority structures, I think the Bible picture is that they tend toward abuse, and they tend toward moral decline. That should not give us great confidence in governments, by the way, especially if they're just ungodly in their. Anyway, number four, Moses' law. Interesting that Moses' law was described. Moses himself describes it in Deuteronomy 4 as the wisdom of the nation, and in contrast to the rest of the world, the peoples, the Gentiles. The peoples, the Gentiles, would look at the Israelites and say, man, what a wise nation they are. And they would know that by just looking at their laws. You should go look in Deuteronomy chapter 4, beginning about verse 5. What other nation is there that has laws like that and has a God, an El, that's so near them as Israel has with Yahweh, you know? And so anyway, but part of that, then I think, what God is showing in that is this is kind of how laws ought to work. And in that, Moses' law taught that injustice pollutes the nation. Here's the verses about that. If you kill somebody, the murderer has to be put to death. And if you don't do that, the blood defiles the land. And no atonement can be made except by the blood of the one who shed it. Right? Do not defile the land which you inhabit, in the midst of which I dwell. For I, the Lord, or Yahweh, dwell among the children of Israel. And then reading, this is the bonus material I was mentioning a while ago. Even now, James seems to say that the rich have miseries coming upon them. Why? Because your gold and silver are witness. You heaped up treasure, and the cries of the reapers and the wages you kept back by fraud cry out. And so you're being fattened as in the day of slaughter. So kind of a frightening picture of crime, and how in some way or another it's building up punishment that has to be executed in the land. Israel, especially Israel, but not only Israel, and other nations were punished for their national wickedness. There is such a thing. I understand there's individual sin, but in that God has allowed these nations, or called them up actually with a purpose, they are also have a collective evil about them. Exodus 19 illustrates that. You shall be me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation if you obey my voice. And he also said, because of these nations are defiled, do not defile yourselves with these nations which I'm casting out before you, for the land is defiled. Therefore, I visit the punishment of its iniquity upon it. So God's saying that's why you're able to conquer the land. And of course, Jonah was told to go and cry against the city of Nineveh. Because of their collective wickedness and so on. There are so many other passages, especially related to the nation of Israel. But there is such a thing, it seems like, as national wickedness, which God eventually takes care of. And who did the lesson on Habakkuk recently? Was it Eric? Yeah, it was Eric. Was it last Sunday night? I don't remember. It was a good lesson. I could remember more about the lesson than when he did it. They all looked the same on the computer screen. That's my excuse anyway. But, you know, he was just saying, you're going to punish Israel with those people? And so, yep, because Israel was wicked, but I'll take care of those other people, the Chaldeans, I'll take care of them too. So another example of that. And God rules among the nations, as we expected he would, because he is a personal God who reaches into this created world and guides it, and by his providence works out plans. And so, the fact that he rules among the nations is no big surprise. not only that, but he holds rulers accountable for their actions. And here are a few verses you're probably familiar with this. Daniel 2, he changes the times and seasons. He removes kings and he raises up kings. In chapter 4, kind of one of my favorites there in Daniel, the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. That is not a compliment, right? He's not saying he picks humble leaders. He's saying that he picks foolish leaders. And he has a purpose in doing that. He's ruling. And I wonder sometimes if we don't live in some of those same times where for some purpose, the lowest of men have been placed in positions of authority. Acts 12 is one of those men, Herod, who dressed up and didn't give God the glory, and God took care of him. Kind of an instant example of God setting and taking out, setting up and taking out rulers in his plan. Question number 7 is about Jesus' kingdom. Does he intend for it to be a kingdom that rules by political, that is majority rule, or by military? You know, that is by might or by what's the word? Surveillance and, you know, enforced compliance. Is that the way Jesus' kingdom is set? And you know this passage very well. My kingdom is not of this world. If they were, my servants would fight. There's a sense in which we are engaged in warfare, but not the way Herod would have, Pilate would have understood it. So they're not going to fight, especially in that act of sacrifice that Jesus was about to undergo. Matthew 22, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God's the things that are God's. Luke 12, this is an interesting story. The man interrupted Jesus almost as if this powerful would-be king or about to be king would be just the guy to settle this dispute he had with his brother who wouldn't give him his share of the inheritance. How did Jesus answer that? Did he? And Jesus, who knew the hearts of all men, he could have said, you know you don't deserve that inheritance. Or he could have said, go check with your brother. He's going to have a stomach ache until he gives you your share or something like that. But none of that. He just said, that's not what I'm here for. I'm not here to settle civil disputes. And so anyway, maybe I'm exaggerating the application there, but I think the guy was way off base in listening to Jesus preaching, at least. And then Jesus said to Pilate, yes, you do have authority, but it came from God, and you're accountable. And so are those who delivered me to you. So anyway, that's number 7. Number 8, what does the Bible say governments are for? Remember, we've kind of said God did put governments in place. And I wonder what he put them in place for. And just thinking about the foundation principles, can you think of some ideas about in a fallen world that's kind of usually on its way down? What are some things that governments, maybe I should kind of hide the, what are some purposes that God might have put governments in place for? And now you can just speculate. You don't have to come up with a Bible passage, but look at the history of the world in the first 6 chapters of Genesis. Which way did it go? It went down really fast, right? Until you get to the flood and every single man and every single thought and every single intent was evil, except for Noah, of course. But what role could government play in that? I wonder. I wonder what purpose he might have had. I'm going to unmute everybody and wait for an answer just because I think I need to wake you up somehow.
Well, the issue in Noah's time is that they were violent continually, and evil tends to take a higher position because it's willing to use violence or any means to gain the upper hand. So there needs to be something that physically controls that in a way, and governments do that.
History is proving that bad government's better than no government.
Yes, that's true. And you can see why. At least there are a few people that enjoy order, even if it's an abusive and maybe inequitable in some way. At least it's some order, and you can know what to expect. Nate, you went off mute for a second there, but I know you have lots of thoughts on this. do you want me to give a plug for your website, or is that on your website yet? The bear story.
Oh, it's up there.
All right.
But to answer your question, well, I think it's mostly to give us peace, right? If you can provide just a base level of peace, yeah, so we can spread the gospel, that's the main thing we're looking for, you know?
Yeah, and we get to that, especially, we'll see about what our responsibility to governments is. But in some sense of an ideal, and I wonder sometimes why nations always get destroyed. They get so evil, they kind of implode or they self-destruct, and something else comes along which might be better, I don't know. But then there's some period of peace, even if it's just dictatorial, no rights for anybody, but at least they don't get killed, you know, kind of thing. And I think there's some sense in which maybe governments, I'm speculating, God put them there. Even human, evil governments have some sense of order about them. As Sewell said, it's better than just no government. Just was it in a total anarchy like that, just the strong people that will survive. And maybe lucky and strong. I don't know, but maybe a little bit better than that in sense of order.
Marty?
Yes.
Couldn't we also just the fact that man is spiritual? Because we're spiritual, there's something in us that makes us want to have justice or things fair. So, I don't, you know, that's why we didn't come up with government.
Because
God put that in us.
That's a wonderful thought, and I wasn't planning to say that. But in some ways, that's true. Is that spiritual side of even the most fallen of men, you know, longs for some sense of order and probably has some sense of right, of loyalty, and you shouldn't get away with that, and you shouldn't be mean to innocent and harmless people. And we innately have that, and we can't ourselves make that happen, right? I think you're saying you just long for we long for the big brother to come in and make, you know, beat these kids up that are abusing me, you know what I mean? Somehow or another, something take care of that. Yeah, that's a real good point. I think there is within all is this longing for the right kind of order and the right kind of justice, and maybe we try to achieve that. And some governments are built on kind of those aspirations, I think. Especially if the culture has some influence of Christianity or something.
Marty, the scripture that would go with that might be Romans 13:3, for rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad.
Yeah, and what kind of rulers was Paul probably talking about in that?
Yeah, the worst.
Yeah, the Romans. I mean, that's the title of the book for one thing, but yeah. And yet, they had some sense of order. And I think a ruler that wants to stay in power realizes that he can't just be totally evil in every way. There must be some facade of justice and of vengeance on evil and that kind of thing. Great, great discussion. Thank you for that. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Did that wake everybody up? Yes, Alberta.
Yeah. You know what I was thinking about? How the government viewed Christ? Because it seemed like they thought that he was a threat.
Yes, ma'am.
To their setup.
Yeah. And did Jesus say some things that maybe accused them of something? I mean, I'm thinking about Herod, and you know, John the Baptist got in trouble for criticizing Herod. Mm-hmm. But certainly the Jewish leaders, who really were the engine behind it. I don't think the Roman government cared much about it except keeping the peace with the Jews, but the Jews certainly felt threatened, no doubt about it. And not only did they feel threatened, they felt criticized and accused and condemned, actually, by what Jesus said. Which, I'm not going to get into that, but you can see, now I will say a little bit about that. You can see, I heard a story the other day about the best dictators ever, and the best dictators ever were almost always totally paranoid. They believed that everyone was out to get them. And whether they were or they weren't, they got rid of their enemies, or perceived enemies, right? And really, so the best meaning the ones that lasted the longest, the dictators, were always the ones who were the most paranoid. And so if you want to pick a ruler to be a dictator, pick one who is, you know, absolutely will not tolerate, you know, dissent or any kind of opposition or criticism. That person would make a good dictator if they were given the opportunity. Okay, keep going. government does exist for these purposes, and I think we can find a lot of different Bible passages that illustrate some of these purposes, but I think it illustrates really, I'm going to go back to what Aaron was saying, there is this desire for justice. Absent God striking people with lightning bolts whenever they committed a crime, we kind of long for this sense of order, and God's placed something like that in the world. And here are some of the purposes that he put them there. Preventing crime, Ecclesiastes 8, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, the hearts of the sons of men is set to do. So I believe the contrapositive to that is, and that is that people won't commit crimes if they know they're going to be punished quickly, right? That'd be the logical equivalent of that. Deuteronomy 25, if there's a dispute, then you want these judges who are supposed to be righteous, and they're going to justify the righteous and condemn the wicked, so you can prevent exploitation where somebody is doing evil. Somebody can appeal, say, hey, this is bad, and then the wicked person can be condemned. There is a sense of vengeance for evil that governments have, where an individual like me does not. So you can read this passage. I think Paul is making reference to these passages here. An avenger. Another purpose is to reward good and punish evil, 1 Peter 2. And again, I'm thinking Nero is the top of the Roman government that Peter is talking about here, but still, in some sense, the role of government is to punish evildoers and to praise those who are good, good in some civil sense, I suppose. And Deuteronomy 17, sometimes things are just difficult to know who's right and who's wrong. You know, I think the guy owes me more money than he thinks he owes me, and that happens. And neither of us may be evil in that, maybe not trying to exploit one another, but it's just difficult. And I think the property line's here, and he thinks it's over here, and so somebody needs to arbitrate that dispute in some way that keeps the peace and keeps us from taking matters into our own hands. And finally, James.
So Deuteronomy 17, 8 through 12, that's actually, I was in the courthouse in one of the waiting on the rooms for if I was going to be on a case. That's one of the pictures. They have that Deuteronomy 17, 8 through 12 on the wall.
No kidding. In a plaque? Man.
Yes.
I guess people don't know that that's close to 10 commandments or it's like.
That's right. Yeah.
So I'd be protest if they knew where Deuteronomy was, I guess, or who Deuteronomy was. Okay. So, right. And somebody, I think Nate mentioned keeping peace. That's what we pray for. And there's some implication that kings and those in authority can have an influence on whether we have peaceful lives or not. I think implied in that command to prayer. So those are things that government is intended to do. And in a fallen world, does so very imperfectly. But those are some things there. We already discussed the fact that we suspected this was going to be so because the whole world lies under the influence of the evil one. But this may surprise you. Human governments are usually bad. There are a lot of anecdotal illustrations of that. The one thing I always think about Absalom, who stood at the gate of the city, right? His dad was king, but Absalom wished he was. And so he basically made a bunch of political promises that, if I were elected, I would, get all these benefits for you, right? And I would protect your special class and make sure you got justice and, right? Now, we never have anything like that in our system, where people who want to be elected make promises that if I were elected, I would help. And really depends on which group they're campaigning in front of as to who they're going to actually help, of course, right?
Never heard of that before.
Never happened, right? If you're in front of the National Rifle Association, you make a lot of different promises there than if you're in front of some other group, right? But the American Civil Liberties Union or something. Anyway, I'm getting too political, but this really has been typical. And our rulers often able to live up to those promises. They have. Their aspiration is not for the justice of those whom they're talking to. Really, what are their aspirations? Why are they saying that? What was Absalom's motive?
Desire for power, control.
He wanted to get elected, right? I'm elected is the wrong word, of course, but He wanted to be king.
And he wanted to be king.
Yeah, and that is a, you know, one of those great temptations, probably rooted in some kind of self-interest that it, you know, drives lots of people to say and do things that are not good. And that's one, maybe one of the reasons that human governments struggle to be what they should be, or what God would have them be in the ideal, which doesn't exist in a fallen world. Matthew 5 makes an interesting story there. I picture the guy that, you know, he's having one of those, you owe me money, you know, no, I don't, you do too, don't. And then finally, so I'm taking you to court, you know, and I send you a letter by my lawyer, right? And Jesus tells the story, and he kind of explains the story on out there. He said, that's a bad move. You're going to go to the judge, and he's not going to execute what you want. He's going to hand you the officer who doesn't care who you are. He just wants to get you into the debtor's prison. And you're going to get thrown in prison, and the prisoners don't care anything about you either. They just know you're in there with them. And with every one of them, of course, you're innocent. Otherwise, you wouldn't be there. And so, and he says, you're not going to get out till you just end up paying all the money. This is an interesting caricature, it seems to me, of the legal system. And what's his point to the kingdom citizen? Is it, should we depend on these human authorities for our justice, or should we just be agreeable people?
Try to work it out.
Yeah, work it out. And I wonder if there's even a kind of love your enemies or go the extra mile in this same sermon, you know, where you might just say, okay, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
And right. So Luke 18, there was a judge who did not fear God nor regard man. I wonder if that's ever happened before. I think Jesus took the story probably right out of the current events. Of course, different lesson. I'm just saying he told that story. And I love this reference in Acts 24. You know, very formal setting. Paul is acknowledged. You may begin your oratory now. And he begins quite formally. Inasmuch as I know that you have been for many years a judge of this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself. You can just imagine the formality, Paul, I think, fitting in his speech to the rhythms and the, you know, the oratory of the day. And meanwhile, jump down to verse 26, you know, what was the motive for Felix? What was happening? What was the reason for this whole rigmarole charade here? He was hoping to get a bribe, you know. And I wonder sometimes if you look at all the formalities and pomp and ceremony and all that that rides on the surface of political activities. I'm being too cynical in this lesson, but I'm sorry. These are Bible pictures. Meanwhile, in the background, somebody's just hoping to get some money out of this, you know. And I think that's the picture that's painted here in this trial. All right. And this is not a surprise to us, but a lot of illustrations. As a result, Christians should be better than non-Christian judges. And maybe this is just a sub-point to illustrate the fact that because we should have a wisdom that is not from this world but comes from above. And as a result of that, Paul says, if there's Christians among you that are having some kind of dispute, do not take it to ungodly judges. There should be people among you that have a wisdom that comes from God that's way superior to anything you're going to get from that judge that Jesus talked about in Matthew 5. And one of the translations, I think it's in New King James, says, if you do that before unbelievers, it's an utter failure. I don't remember which version says that, but it's almost like, that's the dumbest failure thing that you could do. And I think as Christians, we would do well to think about that. And I think we're in a Christian family that has very wise people. And I hope if I ever have a dispute that requires it, and I'm not willing to, as Paul says in that very same text, rather be defrauded, which is probably the right thing to do, is that I would go for binding arbitration to a Christian man or men that I trusted. And so that's just a side point. Nations are judged, and this is very similar, in fact, maybe even the same point as number 5, but God does just, yes, they're punished and they're judged for their wickedness, and I think some of the same verses there. But here, the rulers of these nations are actually mentioned there. Proverbs 14, righteousness exalts a nation. Sin is a reproach to any people. Here, Micah describes the kind of corruption in some of the cities and so on. Anyway, so what's our responsibility? This is question number 12. I believe that's the last of the questions. There's just a bunch of, oh, no, 13. Yeah, that's right. There's more. Anyway, we're to obey. So I think there's several things. Be subject to the governing authorities. Don't speak evil of the rulers. Paul said in Acts chapter 20, probably quoting in the Old Testament. So responsibility one, obey, be in subjection, respectful. Remember who created these authorities. As imperfect as they are,
God.
And their purpose is a good one, whether it's carried out perfectly or not in this fallen world, it has a good purpose. And so we should do our part to try to be in subjection, be respectful and supporting. Pay what you owe. And so you pay taxes, you obey laws, and you set an example of good behavior. Don't resist the authorities. Don't be a rebel. Don't be subversive. Don't be a traitor. I guess you could add that. Proverbs 24, fear the Lord and the king, and do not associate with those given to change. I think that means don't join the band of insurrectionists or insurgents or whatever the word would be, because they're kind of destined for ruin. So don't advocate or support rebellion, whatever change is. And I think in our system, just Marty's opinion, it doesn't mean we wouldn't necessarily be in favor of or support in a legal way some change of laws, but I would not oppose that in a way that would represent civil disobedience, disobedience of any kind, in some way that goes outside the system as a way of making the change. That, it seems to me, is a change. That really is a change of the system itself. And finally, make prayers for the rulers and give thanks. And so we have a kind of a humble attitude. And I always think of the things that Sewell said about when you live in a foreign country, you're certainly not going to cause any trouble. You live in subjection to those laws, realizing there's a larger picture and that really you're not subject to that nation. And the other thing would be, don't depend on their legal systems for settling your disputes. I think Jesus pretty well taught that. And we should be examples, I think, of non-litigation. I know there are people who may do many evil things that are legal, right? Or they use lawyers to get things that really are not ethical or just or anything. They just happen to be somehow a loophole in the legal system. That is a way to live, but it's not the way Christians would live. And keep going. Live by love. Do good. Be patient. Even if we're punished for righteousness' sake. We are people who live with that. And so a lot of teaching on that, I think, because governments are so much a part of our lives. And we have a temptation to either depend on them or to oppose them. Either extreme is probably wrong and kind of gets us too entangled in this world.
Hey, Marty.
Yes.
Yes. Do you want us to save our comments till the end? Or?
No, go ahead if it's relevant now. And I can tell by the tone of your voice, you're going to ask me a hard question.
No, I hope not.
Oh, okay. I was going
to
mute you if you were going to do that.
This just brings to mind to me, you know, whether it's water cooler talk, whether it's soccer mom talk, whether it's on the internet, I think how we project our response to any of these things that are happening, whether it's our fear over COVID-19 or whether it's whether you like or don't like any of our politicians, I think it's, this class to me just seems to really point to the fact that we need to show ourselves as a light in the world and not be fearful in front of everybody or not be disrespecting our governor or whatever it might be. And I think that we really have to work on that.
Thank you. And really, I one of my many faults as a teacher is I never get to the point where we're making reasonable everyday applications. So thanks, Patrice. That is certainly one. And I think now, of course, you know, it doesn't really matter what the governor of the state came out with. Somebody would be angry about it, right? And same thing with the president and others. And I'm thinking about the T-shirt lady and whoever responds to her says, you know what, I don't really think governments make that much difference with regard to the important things, the morality, you know, relationship with God kind of questions, which should be the most important things in our lives. And certainly if we think we can enlist governments to help with some of those issues, we're using the wrong tools. That's not what's there. But you're right, the example we set. Why do I think of Facebook? Because I have seen Christians that just, they, and I think one thing is our Christian view says that my first reaction would be to think, well, how does this relate to my relationship with God or to the kingdom or to the spread of the gospel on the earth? I think of that first. That's my worldview. That's the lens through which I see everything. I think there's some people that see everything through free market, laissez-faire, economy. That's the issue. If you don't have that, you don't have anything. Or they see it through the lens of racism and how to solve that and point it, call it out where it exists and fix it and all that. Or economic inequity or whatever. If that's your central theme in life, you're going to see everything through that lens, right? I'm sorry, Teresa, I'm saying way more than you said. I hope it's not too much of a disagreement.
No, that's it. Yeah, that's exactly it.
Also, I remember, you know, the discussion that has gone around when, say, there's some popular performance or something, and everybody's, you know, throws their hands up over something that was done poorly or something like that, or what someone wore. And I mean, I think as Christians, we shouldn't be surprised that the world is evil. You know.
Yeah.
You know, I just think probably shouldn't be watching it, but in the first place, but you know. Yeah. The world is evil. What do you expect? Kind of a thing. And so I think as Christians, we should be projecting the right kind of focus instead right. of all up in arms over things all the time.
It's not quite apathy. And I'll come back to Sewell's illustration. If you're living in a foreign country and there's stupid things going on, you're aware of it. You know, you maybe even have some opinions about it, right? But really, it doesn't matter. You're going home in a few months, right? And so it's kind of not relevant. And I wonder if that's not the way we ought to be viewing this nation. And, you know, and I was thinking tonight, I was microwaving my little supper. it's leftovers. I don't buy microwave meals, but still, I had a few minutes while the thing was humming away, heating up my food. And I was thinking, you know, we use the phrase for God and country. And I think that's, in a way, don't you think that sounds like you're putting those two on an equal weight? I love my country and whatever's going on. I'm patriotic. And I love and oh yeah, and I love God too. In fact, I go to church on Sunday and sing and stuff like that. And somehow or another, that's just I don't know. It's something about that phrase. I know it's the heart and soul of country music, but still, it seemed like it's maybe the wrong worldview, if I can say that. Okay, we're almost done. Y'all are hanging in there. Thank you for that. Okay. And finally, there's a special accountability that God, I think, calls rulers into, that they are actually especially accountable for how they conduct themselves. And sure enough, he sets even the lowest of men over the nations. But this little Proverb 31 for Lemuel, he's kind of like, you know, you really have a responsibility as a ruler to judge righteously. You're placed in that by God's creation and his plan. You have a responsibility. In a sense, you're a surrogate for the judgment that God isn't, you know, executing speedily. Perhaps you're there. You have a responsibility to take vengeance, to purify the land of the blood of the innocent that's shed. That's a pretty heavy responsibility. So I'm a little comforted to know that God will take care of evil rulers and he holds them to a special accountability. And I think that's probably true for elders and other authority structures. Teachers, what does James say about teachers receiving the greater condemnation? I think there's a special judgment perhaps for rulers who are put there for a purpose. And when they don't do it, that's another evil that cries out for vengeance, just like the blood of a murdered person would. You can read these passages. They're in the lesson material. But there's a special judgment for that. All right, I'm going to summarize with a much simpler chart, but these are the points we've tried to make, and I think you all could kind of see this from your group sessions, but here they are. Number one is that here in this world, even without God in the picture, authority structures are required to try to impose order on a world that's not subject to God. And I think the point that I've already forgotten. I think Aaron made it. You know, we just long for that. We long for some sense of justice and order and peace, and know a bad government's better than none. And so you could say it evolves because man wants order. I think it's part of God's plan to put that desire within us. You might even speculate that it's one of the ways in which we kind of look for something bigger than ourselves in these aspirations, feeling, groping for something like God that's bigger than us, that makes things right, that fixes us, that protects us, that puts order in the world. Anyway, they're there. It's a creation of God, and that's the reason it's there. But God sets up those governments. That's what we learn in the Old Testament especially. He sets them up, and he takes them away. And I think there's something healthy in this cycle of government so that we don't have the same one that gets worse and worse over centuries and centuries. We really just need some resets every once in a while. That's Marty's opinion. God's wisdom is way above that. I'm sure he has a reason, but part of it might be that we just need relief every once in a while as a human race. I don't know. Anyway, but God sets them up and removes them. And, you know, nations are punished for not punishing criminals. And God holds each man accountable individually, but the governments are also held accountable for not punishing. Human governments are imperfect and unreliable, just like everything else in this world, right? My washing machine is an example. Just anything is subject to break and decay. And in spite of that, Christians honor and obey human governments because who set them up? Romans 13 is God put them in place with some plan in mind. And we learn from the Habakkuk sermon that there's a plan that I probably don't understand. And I wouldn't believe it even if someone told me, is what God said to Habakkuk, if you remember. God will judge men who rule in human government. So remember, governments are just made up of other men. They're as accountable to God as we are. And God judges them individually as well, perhaps more harshly. And finally, with all of that picture, it seems to me obvious that we shouldn't be depending on human government for our security or as a force to promote moral behavior. Despite what the t-shirt lady thinks, that's not really the path to make the nation better, right? Because we're working through an imperfect and and probably temporary arrangement at best. So that was the lesson. All right, I'm going to stop the recording unless, I'm sure there's some comments. I'm going to unmute everybody, so say whatever you want, and then I'm going to, at some point, stop the recording, and we can socialize after that. All right, any other comments?
Thank you for a good class.
Marty, your observation about God and country, if that's universally accepted by Christians, it divides us. Because my country is the United States. Another Christian's country is England. Another one's France or South Africa or Nigeria or Japan. But it has to be God that unites us. But too much concern about country divides us.
Yeah. I wonder if that happened in the New Testament with Jews and Gentiles, the same thing. Yeah. Good point. Thank you. Others? James, go ahead.
But I had a politician stop by and like you said, was telling us all the great things they could do and those things like that. And I said, well, what are you going to – I said, I understand the things you're saying. I said, but they're not going to do anything for the soul of man. I said, there's something going on. And you can't throw money at it. You can't do all these other things with it. And I said, as soon as someone mentions something like that, you're like, you think you want, oh, you want to make God the ruler in the United States. I said, you just need to understand. I said, you're going about it. There's a wickedness in man that can't. Something has to control him from the inside. And you're trying to do things on the outside, and it'll never work. And I think that you see the frustration in government trying to control men, and it's not working. I said, the only thing is the gospel of Jesus Christ is going to change them. But it's just interesting. You can see the frustration with the rules and everything. How do we make men behave? And they said, you can't do it physically. I mean, you can, but it doesn't really change him. I said, you want the man to change. And I said, it's only the gospel that does that.
So, I heard a survey that was conducted by, or at least sponsored by, and reported on, I would say, a fairly liberal radio news network. And they had surveyed a bunch of these crazy evangelical, right-wing, you know, Trump supporters, whatever. And they reported with horror that, and I'm not in favor of this radio station or of this right-wing, none of those. I'm just reporting who made the reaction one. That of these people who they said, if you if the government said something and the Bible said something different, this was hard for these people they're reporting to believe. It seemed like 70% of these people they surveyed thought they should go with what the Bible said, as opposed to the government. And that, you know, that was reported kind of with horror. And I made up 70 because I don't remember the number, but it was like 2/3. It was in that category. And they were almost like saying, can you imagine people would just do what the Bible said rather than the government? That was kind of seen as kind of an unbelievable thing. Like, obviously, the majority rule is always right, isn't it? Isn't that? I mean, on the people on the broad way and the narrow way and all that. But anyway, sorry. That's okay.
I have a question.
Uh-oh.
You may not be able to answer this, but do we have any reason to believe that God has changed his approach with dealing with nations in terms of judging them for a current sin?
That's a good question. I might just hand that off to Sewell or something. I thought you were going to say, has he changed his approach from, say, the nation of Israel to today? Because it does seem like there was something special about God setting up a civil system in the nation of Israel, you know, but only for the nation of Israel. It really didn't apply to the other nations. All the covenants and circumcision and religious regulations didn't really apply. And yet it seemed like it was a model for how civil government should operate. That's not your question, is it? Your question is, does he still execute vengeance on nations for their national wickedness or something like that? And does he still set up rulers as he did in the Old Testament? Is that kind of, that's the question you're asking?
Yeah.
You asked the negative. Is there any evidence that he doesn't do that anymore?
I think
it's a proper way to phrase it. Yeah, thanks for asking it that way. I think I would say I can't think of any evidence. I can think of some evidence, mainly the book of Revelation, where it looks as if God, you know, in the spiritual realm and then finally in history is going to take vengeance on those enemies of the Christians, you know. And the Christians that are maybe symbolized there in the throne scene are crying, how long, when are you going to do what you always do, you know, take care of things and make things right? I paraphrased terribly on that, but still. Any other thoughts on that? I think Mikhail is asking, does God rule differently in the nations of men, including setting up rulers and, you know, allowing nations to conquer other nations? Is he doing that differently now? Is there any evidence that he's doing it differently now than he has, say, in the Old Testament times?
The only reason we know that God was involved when we look at the Old Testament is because he told us. But I think about it, from people from the outside, it just looked like another nation came and beat up another nation.
Yeah.
So he could still be doing the same. And to us, it just looked like somebody with a superior military force or some coup that happened in the middle of the night or something like that. To us, it just looks like human beings behaving like what human beings do. And it could be that God is behind it. Like I said, unless he told us, like he told those prophets and other things, this is exactly, that's why Habakkuk said, excuse me, what are you saying? I don't believe you're going to do this. He wouldn't have believed it. He would have thought that this country was just coming to just beat them up, but not that God was the instrument behind their the punishment.
So, Michaela, I'll just spin what you said a little bit. One of the things I think James is saying is, It still is just as unknowable to us as it ever was in time. So it may look different to us because we're living in the middle of it, but it always looked funny. It always kind of invisible, I guess. And that's what you're saying, James. Invisible is not the right word. Inscrutable, I think, you know, that kind of thing. So.
Well, you have after Christ, you have Herod, and you have destruction of Jerusalem, and all those are things that God says these are going to happen.
Right.
And I'm going to bring them about. And so, like, I don't know at what point after those God would then say, okay, well, now.
I'm letting everything go.
Yeah, now I'm going to change things a little bit.
Yeah, and I think you could add to that list the if you want to interpret Revelation this way, which I tend to, you know, the destruction of the Roman Empire is, you know, it's just part of that same narrative, that at that point we had some window into what God was doing, similar to the prophets in the Old Testament. We just don't have that window today. But so I guess, Michaela, I would say you asked the question much more easily than you could have. Is there any evidence that? And I guess I would say no. But
I just, the question came from, I had the misfortune of meeting some people who were protesting that are describing the current state of America to its own wickedness.
And what?
Its own wickedness, saying that the reason why America is the way it is now is because God is punishing us. It's even that we've done as a nation. And I just was, when I was talking to the guy, I was just like, how can you really ascribe anything to God? Like, you know, aren't
people
we come from this place of we cannot know. So, but that was kind of their refute, is like the Old Testament. And I was like, well, I don't know what to say. So.
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't doubt for a minute God still rules in the nations. I also don't doubt that I don't have a clue what he's doing any more than Habakkuk did. But it's kind of comforting to think that God kind of thinks a little bigger than I do. I'm glad he does. Otherwise, I'd be in trouble. We'd all be in trouble. And maybe I'm better off not even knowing what all he has in mind, you know, but yeah. It's probably too trite to say that he's the same yesterday and today. I think that's probably just too much of a generalization, but anyway, I don't know that his methods are that different. Good question. Thank you for that.
Well, thank you for answering.
Or I didn't answer.
And to everybody else who answered.
Marty.
Yeah, Jerry.
My comment would be, we know there's been wars, and in Revelation it says there'll be wars, and rumor of wars before the end. So that might help her. I think God does get involved. He looks at which is the best and which is the worst, because we have nations, defeating nations, and like, you know, when Germany had Nazis, and he realized that was the worst, even though we have good and evil. So there's always, you know, we've always seen wars and rumors of wars.
Yeah, that's right. It's hard to know who's evil, more evil, a free nation that's completely immoral or a totally dictatorial nation that has some semblance of morality. I can't judge which is more evil in God's sight. I don't know. That's one of the thousands of things I don't know. Okay, I'm going to stop the recording unless somebody stops me right away.